Well, I guess right off the bat, I'll ask you, who was Richard Harding Davis?
Ah, well, it's funny you should ask, because if you'd asked that question 80 years ago, people would have thought you were mad. At the turn of the century, he was about the most famous man in the country, at least after the president. He was a war correspondent, primarily. He also wrote best-selling fiction and plays. He was physically the model for the man with the Gibson girl. He was the model for what a debonair, handsome young man would look like in the 1890s. His picture was up on every schoolboy's wall. He was every girl's heartthrob. Through the 1890s and the early part of the century, and then soon after his death in 1916 during World War I, he was almost immediately thereafter forgotten.
Isn't that strange? He was born in Philadelphia, wasn't he?
He was. He was born during the Civil War. His father became the editor of the city's most important paper, the Philadelphia Public Ledger. His mother wrote a book called Life in the Iron Mills, a novel that was a big success in her day. This is just before Richard was born. She kept writing, but she became more and more a hack. And Life in the Iron Mills has been rediscovered by feminist critics. It's a good book, and it catapulted her to what fame was then. This is in pre-Civil War America, namely that the editor of The Atlantic printed her story. She was invited to Boston. She met Emerson and Hawthorne and all the great writers of the day. But celebrity then is not what celebrity became in her son's lifetime. She was famous to a small group of intellectual people, not a picture that people would have posted on their bedroom walls.
It was not surprising that Davis became a writer. He came from a writing family.
That's true. And his brother, who also became a writer, although a less good one, said that he never considered any other career. And while it's true that he became a writer like his parents, he did become a totally different writer, which I think had something to do with the different time in which he lived. As I was saying, he was a writer who demanded to be on stage rather than backstage, whereas his mother, happily for much of her career, published anonymously. Richard, from the time he was a very small boy, was always thinking about his byline and how to get it as big as possible. He, as a writer, wrote fiction in which the protagonists invariably were young, handsome, adventurous, easily confused with Richard Harding Davis himself. So that I think one of the interesting things for me about the book was that to be a successful writer at the time of the Civil War or immediately thereafter, one could be like Richard's mother, Rebecca Harding Davis, a fairly anonymous figure and really just concentrate on writing. By Richard's day, you had to be mentioned in the newspaper columns. You had to be known to a wide public in a number of ways that are remarkably similar to what it means to be a successful writer today.
Davis had a relatively abortive college career at Lehigh. Tell me about that.
Yeah, he was not a very good student. He claimed that he had too much energy to sit and study. He was always more interested in making the dramatic gesture, and he was successful both as a football player, and I should pause to say that he was a terrible football player, but he had a lot of spunk, and he was able to score the first touchdown in Lehigh's history, which he was very proud of all his life. He also became the editor of the Lehigh Burr, the college paper. But in his junior year, having spent very little time on his coursework, he was asked to withdraw from Lehigh, and he told the faculty, somewhat in a state of shock, that they might be asking him to leave Lehigh now, but they would find that he had gone further in life than any of them had gone, which was a bit much for a 19-year-old, but he was right.
He published his first book while in college.
Yes, he published a little book, which he called Adventures of My Freshman. It was privately printed. He went and helped, with a friend of his, helped sell advertising to support the cost. And to his delight, the first edition, which his parents had subsidized, sold out. And so he was very chagrined when his parents refused to subsidize a second edition. And in the story that as he told it, much later, while exploring their attic, saw the entire first edition and realized why they were so reluctant to subsidize a second. Hard to know whether that was entirely true, because Davis's personal style was very British. He was an Anglophile, and he liked to tell self-deprecating stories like that, stories that in which he made fun of himself a little bit, but not too much, which in a way helped fend off other people's criticisms of him.
What did Davis do after college?
After flunking out of Lehigh, he tried for another year at Johns Hopkins. That didn't go much better, so he got a newspaper job, and he worked for several Philadelphia newspapers. He was fired from his first job, again, really because he failed to apply himself. He was sports interested him a great deal, and he was more interested in hanging around the sports desk than in writing his daily stories. He also dressed in a manner that was guaranteed to antagonize many of his fellow reporters. He had a whole personal style that he had cultivated from books, really, and especially from Thackeray and other 19th century British writers. So he would wear an ulster, you know, this long striped coat and yellow gloves, and carry a walking stick, which didn't make him very popular among his fellow journalists. And the city editor told him one night that he should take off his gloves and sit down and write his story. And when a few minutes later he was still standing at the sports desk with his gloves on, he was told right then and there that he was fired. After that, he did apply himself. His next job, he worked very hard on all of these stories that any of us who've worked for newspapers are familiar with. You do a story for Arbor Day, and you do a story for Thanksgiving, and there are all the sorts of stories that Cub reporters are assigned. And he did them with enormous energy and imagination. And right after that, his star began to rise. Pivotal story in Philadelphia was when he had the notion that he would impersonate a hoodlum. And he dressed up as a hoodlum and naturally had himself photographed, because he had himself photographed at every stage of his career. And he was able to persuade members of this gang that he was an out-of-town hoodlum, burglar, looking for work. And the leader of the gang taught him all of the con tricks, again, which haven't changed too much. They had a shell game very much like three-card Monte that you still see on the streets of New York. At the end of his apprenticeship, he disappeared, and then a day later, his story appeared describing how these hoodlums operated. It caused a big sensation and really made his name in Philadelphia.
He landed a job on the New York Sun and also began contributing to Harper's.
Yes, he left Philadelphia at that time, this being around 1890, actually. New York was the center for newspapers, and newsmen were paid much more here. The papers were much more high profile. And he came to New York. He knew Arthur Brisbane, who was the editor of the New York Evening Sun, and Brisbane gave him a job. And the very first day that he went to work, he was walking, looking very much like a tourist, across the park in front of City Hall, which is where the newspapers were located then. And he was accosted by another con man who took him on an elaborate charade. In the middle of the charade, he was able to go to his new city editor and say that he had been approached by this con man. Could that be his story? In the end, he tackled the con man, brought him to city court, and wrote the story. And it was a page one story, his first day of work, and that actually caused a sensation in New York. So he made his name immediately upon arrival, and then never let up. So that just 2 years later, he was offered what was a huge job, the managing editorship of Harper's Weekly, then one of the very... So the most prestigious weekly in the country, and for a man not yet 30, it was remarkable. And so he did become the managing editor. Unfortunately, he liked the title more than he liked the work, and he wasn't really much of an editor. He liked to get around.
I noticed that he did a lot of traveling during that period, like 6 months at a time. I wonder how he could do any editing.
Well, he didn't do very much, and that was became a gripe with the Harper brothers who ran the firm. At first, it seemed all right to let Davis go away for periods of time, but it became increasingly clear that traveling and writing is what he wanted to do, and editing He mainly liked the title. It was nice to be managing editor of Harper's Weekly if you didn't actually have to edit. But he traveled, yes, he traveled out west at a time when the legend of the West was already beginning and the actuality of the West was already receding. So he was able to, you know, in his travels, as I describe, he could see what, say, the these great rituals like the Indian buffalo hunt had become. He went to a reservation and saw that the buffalo were gone. Instead, the Indians were given a cattle allotment. These steers were driven cross-country. By the time they got to the Indian reservation, they were just skin and bones. And then little Indian boys on horses would shoot arrows into these pathetic steers. This is the sort of reality that he was able to see in the West. And as always with Davis's writing, and it's interesting to see it right through his career, he was very aware and very impressed by the myth, and he always went into a story knowing what the myth was, but he was honest enough and sharp-eyed enough to see when reality didn't measure up to the myth, and in many of his best reports, that's the theme. But he traveled to France, to England, to North Africa, and he was much more interested in traveling. He was waiting really for a war, but it was hard to find one. It was, from his perspective, an unhappily peaceful period of world history, and his ears would prick up whenever he heard rumblings of war, but then inevitably it would die down until he finally got to cover a war, the totally forgotten conflict between Greece and Turkey in 1896, and he went over to Greece. Stephen Crane was the other well-known correspondent in Greece at that time. And he got some good stories. In fact, he did much better than Stephen Crane, who was a much better writer than Davis, and God knows a much, much better fiction writer, but didn't have his repertorial knack.
Davis was also writing fiction. Didn't he create a fictional character by the name of Gallagher?
Yes. Gallagher was Davis's first big short story. He'd done another character before that named Van Bibber, Cortland Van Bibber, who was a mock version of Davis himself, and they were little comic stories. Gallagher was a short story set, he wrote it already in New York, but it was set back in his Philadelphia newspaper days. And it inaugurated a school of fiction, the newspaper fiction, which it seems to me always has a very hard surface but a very mushy center, and there are always sentimental stories, and this one's no exception, in which Gallagher, who's a copy boy, is able to save the day by the plot machinations you don't need to know, but he's able, in a snowstorm, by commandeering a hansom cab, to bring the copy back from the scene of the crime to the newspaper just in time to make the deadline of the next morning's edition. And Gallagher, which is a very lively story, but not, one would say, great fiction, because it was written so early in Davis's career, seemed to herald a very promising literary future for him. And it was acclaimed by people like William Dean Howells and Richard Watson Gilder, who was the editor of The Century, a very important literary magazine then. And while Davis wrote a number of popular stories thereafter, in a way he never exceeded the popularity of Gallagher. It used to irk him that years later he was still known as the man who'd written Gallagher.
How did he happen to become the male model for the young man in the pictures involving the Gibson girls?
He'd met Gibson, Charles Dana Gibson, at about the same time that he met Arthur Brisbane when he was visiting London. This is before he came to New York. And Gibson, I guess recognizing a good thing when he saw it, asked Davis if he would model for him, which he did, and he appeared on the cover of Life magazine, which was then a different magazine from today. It was a humor magazine, but it was very popular. And partly because Davis was writing short stories with characters, as I said, very much like himself, doing all kinds of daring things, some of these stories were illustrated by Gibson. It became a natural sort of alliance. And whereas Gibson modeled the Gibson girl on his wife, Irene Langhorne Davis, Gibson, sorry. He modeled the man on Davis. He was just, he was good raw material. It's a somewhat flattering, shouldn't say it, the ghost of Davis will smack me down, but it was an idealized version of Davis.
Of course, he got his crack at a really good war when the Spanish-American War broke out. Tell me a little bit about his participation in that conflict.
Yes, that was his great war. He was in Europe when it broke out. He was terrified that he might miss it because there was a long period, several months before, when it wasn't clear whether war was going to break out or not between the U.S. and Spain. But he got back in plenty of time. It took a while for the American troops to leave for Cuba. He quickly attached himself to Theodore Roosevelt, who was exactly his type of hero, because Roosevelt was well-born, he was intelligent, and just like Davis, he knew what was he knew a picturesque gesture when he saw one, and Davis was with Roosevelt at the first battle of the war, which is less well known. It was called Las Gasimas, and the Rough Riders were ambushed in an ambiguous ambush, and Davis, in his first reports, seemed to imply that it was indeed an ambush, that the Rough Riders didn't know that Spaniards were hanging in the trees, waiting for them to come down a narrow path. In the later versions of the story, he makes it clear that this was no ambush, that the Rough Riders, and Theodore Roosevelt in particular, knew just what was happening and fought very bravely. And in fact, they did flush out the Spanish in the end, and with some heavy losses, they were able to prevail. But later, the key battle of the war and the key description of the war, which belonged to Richard Harding Davis, was the charge that Teddy Roosevelt led up what the Rough Riders dubbed Kettle Hill. It's come down in history as San Juan Hill because it was part of the San Juan Hills, a series of mountains. San Juan Hill itself is the name that had been given and should be given to the highest hill in the range, and that, in fact, was taken by another general, not by Roosevelt. Anyway, footnote to history. Roosevelt led this charge, which seemed at the time to Davis and others to be almost suicidal. The American troops had come to the edge of a woods, coming down one trail. The Spaniards were facing them in trenches on the San Juan Hills, firing down at them like pigs in a poke. They were stalled there for an hour in horrible heat. When finally Roosevelt was given the order to advance, and leading the troops, which a colonel would not normally have done, and waving his hat, he led this thrilling charge. Not quite like a charge as you might think, because it was through high grass, and they really had to push their way through this grass to get at the Spaniards and flush them off Kettle Hill. But it was the dramatic high point of the war. It was the dramatic high point of Teddy Roosevelt's career, and the legend that came out of the Spanish-American War propelled Roosevelt first to the governor's seat in New York State, then to the vice presidential nomination in 1900, and then, when William McKinley was assassinated, into the White House. So for both Roosevelt and Davis, the Spanish-American War was a very good war indeed.
Now, Davis describes an episode in Cuba involving an execution in which the victim of the execution has a last cigarette, and it became kind of a classic image. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, this piece was called The Death of Rodriguez, and in fact, it predates what the war itself. Before the U.S. and Spain went to war over Cuba, Cuban rebels had been fighting the Spaniards for some years, and Rodriguez was a Cuban patriot who was captured by the Spanish and sentenced to death. And Davis witnessed the execution. All his sympathies were with Rodriguez, and he described how Rodriguez's hands were shackled. He was given a cigarette. It was lit. He smoked it, and then when the bullets hit him, he fell to the ground, and the cigarette fell out of his mouth and was still burning behind in the mud. And that scene of the condemned prisoner smoking the last cigarette and the cigarette burning on after he dies began in Davis's story, and I think is still with us today.
Now, Davis married rather late in life, but he also had a rather unusual marriage, which did not apparently involve sex.
It did not apparently involve sex, that's true. He married when he was 35. He married a woman that he'd known. They had vacationed together, the two families, the Davis family and the Clark family, in the town of Marion, Massachusetts, still a very pleasant seaside resort near Cape Cod. Davis's mother, as I mentioned, Rebecca Harding Davis, was a very overpowering woman, and she had two other younger children than Richard. Neither of them married until her death in her 70s, and they were both, in fact, both of those children were in their 40s when they married. Davis was 35. He married Cecil Clark Davis, who would have been called an advanced woman for her day. She was quite intelligent, quite attractive. She was very talented as a portrait painter and very interested in her career. She was also a very good athlete, billiards player, horsewoman, and a dog fancier. She didn't want to get married. She was only 21. When Davis proposed, she said no. Davis was very upset. He proposed right after the Spanish-American War. Cecil's mother, Louise, was very keen on having Richard as her son-in-law and thought that her daughter was making a great mistake, and she worked on her over the next months, and eventually Cecil accepted. And Davis did this, again, made a very typical gesture. He was living in London at this point. After Cecil refused him, he went over to London in part because he was so unhappy in New York. Cecil lived in Chicago. Richard sent to Cecil a boy, a delivery boy, named Jaggers, who at that time you could hire a boy to deliver mail for you in London. It was quite cheap, and it tended to work at least as well, if not better, as the regularly scheduled mail. He gave Jaggers this letter, and as if it were just a letter to deliver in the West End of London, but it was a letter to deliver in Chicago, and then made a bet that Jaggers could beat the regular mail. Well, it became, somehow or other, Davis claimed he didn't leak it to the press, but always these things tended to leak to the press. It became a huge sensation in London. Would Jaggers beat the regular mail? And this boy, in fact, did beat the regular mail, brought Cecil an engagement ring. It was on all the front pages in London. When Jaggers came back, he was presented to the Queen, and some months afterwards, Richard married Cecil in Marion, Massachusetts.
They had kind of a prenuptial agreement, didn't they?
They did. Cecil, it is clear to us now, but probably was not clear to Richard then, did not have any sexual interest in men. And it was said afterwards that she'd actually negotiated a prenuptial agreement saying that there'd be no physical contact between them. Whether that document, if it ever existed, no longer exists. Although documents like that, it is known, were signed at that time. It seems likely that Richard thought that her aversion to sex was the natural, or at least not unexpected, result of the way proper young women were brought up at that time, and that with once she'd settled into her marriage, she would feel differently. Well, she didn't feel differently. And the marriage creaked along for many years.
She was loyal, though, and actually traveled with him to war sites.
Well, that part of the marriage,
South Africa, for example, during the Boer War.
That part of the marriage she loved. And while their honeymoon was in France, the next year they went to the Boer War together. And that really was the high point of their marriage, because what Cecil really wanted to be was a comrade, not a wife. She loved traveling into South Africa. They started on the English side of the Boer War. The Boer War in 1900 was between the English and the Boers, who were the Afrikaners in South Africa today. They started on the English side, but all of Richard and Cecil's sympathies were with the Boer farmers. They crossed over to the Boer side, and the Boers were just amazed to see a woman there, because, as they told her, all the English women who had been living in Boer territory had left months and months ago. Cecil's dearest wish was to come under enemy fire, which she was able to accomplish. She was entirely calm through the whole thing, although Richard was terrified, not for himself, but for Cecil, thinking, what would he do if she were hit? But neither of them was hit. That was the high point of their marriage.
Now, Richard, as a correspondent, he kind of created a uniform for himself, didn't he?
He did. He was an expert on uniforms, and he decided that the British khaki suited him best. And so he created a modified version of a khaki British uniform, which he wore when he covered campaigns. He also had the best war kit available. And a few years later, when he covered the Russo-Japanese War from the Japanese side, the Japanese high command was so impressed by his equipment that they requested several pieces of it and made copies that they distributed among their staff.
We're talking about a tent and a stove and things like that.
Yeah, his tent was quite amazing, and he had collapsible chairs and very I guess what would then have been high tech water bottles
and a huge entourage to help him.
Yes. Well, you needed a lot of help if you had all of that equipment.
As opposed to the kind of war correspondent we have today, who, unless he's a television person with a camera crew, really goes on by himself.
Yes. Well, Ernie Pyle, I suppose, is the model for today's war correspondent. Davis traveled in a great deal higher style. He insisted on taking a dinner jacket to the battlefront, for instance, so that he could dress for dinner if possible after the day's reportage was completed.
Well, he went to most of the big war scares, the one in Mexico, for example. You mentioned the Russian-Japanese conflict. And wherever he went, he was a celebrity. I think, as you write, many of the correspondents kind of stepped back when he arrived on the scene.
By the end of his career, say the last 10 years, he was such a celebrity that, in a way, he was news. And he would be seated at dinners next to the commanding general. He would go over on the commander's ship if it was that kind of war.
Kind of like the most celebrated television anchors today, huh?
Much like, and if anything, even more so. But the funny thing about Davis is that, as you'd expect, many of his fellow correspondents resented it and resented him and the airs that they thought he was putting on. But when they saw him in action, he worked extremely hard, and it didn't hurt, of course, that he had access to the very highest people in the military chain of command. But he also did legwork that others didn't do. So often the fellow correspondents who started by sneering at him wound up respecting him.
I guess the highlight of his journalistic career may have been during World War I in Belgium. Can you tell me about that, where he describes the invasion of the German troops?
He was in Brussels when the Germans came into the city. And his report of this mass of indistinguishable, perfectly coordinated, brilliantly uniformed, because Davis was always interested in the uniform, and he was able to point out that their uniform was a color gray that disappeared when seen from a distance. His portrait of the German troops entering Brussels was recognized at the time as a classic and has remained in every collection of war reportage. It's brilliant, even if you don't know the circumstances under which it was written, even if you don't know that part of the job, as a reporter's job always is not only to write the story, but get the story out. And since the Germans took the city, they weren't letting anything out, and Davis was able, shades of Jaggers, really, to find a boy who would take the copy and get it into Holland from out of Belgium. But the onomatopoetic quality of this piece of writing, in which you hear the thudding of the horses and the caissons as they come into Brussels, is really a model. It's one of the pieces of Davis's writing that I think has lasted and will continue to.
By the same token, he began writing plays, adapting some of his stories for plays, writing stories, but I think you describe a lot of that work as hack work.
Yeah, what happened was that, like so many writers, Davis quickly acquired the trappings of a very expensive life. And he, the key thing is that after marrying Cecil, he bought himself a house like a country squire in Westchester, in just north of New York City. He eventually had 350 acres, and he built himself a very big house. He constructed a lake, so he had to build a dam. He had a whole household of servants. It was very expensive, and it's sad reading to see him getting a new barrage of bills and wondering where he's going to get the money to pay them. And the way he got the money was to write increasingly hack stories. It's comforting, I guess it's comforting to know that the very last story he wrote out of World War I, which he first called The Man Who Had Everything and then became known as The Deserter, about a group of war correspondents who meet a young American who's enlisted on the British side, has been through a miserable war and wants to desert, is talked out of it by the correspondents, and then leaves their room in Salonika, the Greek city in which these men were covering the war, leaves the room by throwing his filthy putting on the filthy uniform and leaving a puddle of mud behind him, leaving them all very guilty about just what their relationship to this war is, so that they can tell a young man that it's his duty to go back to it. Anyway, the poignant quality of that story exceeded everything that Davis had done since his early writing career. And in a way, one wonders, had he lived longer, if he'd been able to do better. But for the bulk of his career, certainly he did not. I mean,
meanwhile, he shed Cecil and married a young woman who was in vaudeville, and they had a child. There's a photograph, you point out, that Davis is in his 40s and holding his only daughter, and he looks almost like her grandfather.
Yeah, he's in his late 40s. He's close to 50 by that point. And yes, he had a child at an age when many of his peers were becoming grandchildren. He met this woman, do you call it a meeting? He saw her first on the stage. He was a vaudeville star. Young woman, big sensation. She was she played something called the Yama Yama Girl in a musical called the Three Twins, and she did a dance and sang a song, and it was a big sensation in New York. Davis was smitten with her immediately. Went again and again and again to the theater just to see her big number, and finally wangled an introduction. She was naturally suspicious of this older married man who was paying court to her. Eventually, he convinced her that his intentions were serious, and then he had to break the news to Cecil, which was not so easy. She didn't take it very well. You might think, well, it was a sexless marriage. Why would she want to continue it? In fact, she did want to continue it. She was perfectly happy, it seems. She was painting well. She enjoyed being Mrs. Richard Harding Davis and the people and the places that exposed her to. But she wasn't going to fight it, and she acceded to his request for a divorce. And then, at a very late age, soon after his mother's death, because it's hard to imagine how he would have done this had his mother been alive, Richard married Bessie McCoy, a vaudeville star, and soon after had a child.
Yeah, and soon after that he died. I believe he was 51. What year was that?
1916.
And up till the end of his relatively short life, I guess he was turning out hack work.
Well, his last short story was a good one, as I said, the Deserter. He became, after the outbreak of war, he devoted almost all of his energies to to rousing public American interest in the Allied cause, in the cause of the French and the English against the German. He covered the war. He went to Europe twice, two tours of duty, and he exhausted himself, in fact. Although he didn't die on the battlefield, he died of angina that was at least in part aggravated by the privations he endured during that period. It was a record cold winter in northern Greece when he was covering the Balkan War. They claimed it hadn't been that cold in centuries. And he, when he came back from Salonika in the Balkans, he said he could never get warm again.
So outside of one or two stories and some of his reportage, Richard Harding Davis is just not read anymore.
That's true. He wrote a story called The Bar Sinister, a dog story. That's again, it's a minor genre, but it's one of the great dog stories. Several pieces of classic war reporting, and just a few Gallagher is still collected, I think, in some collections. There are a couple of others, but yes, I think he's really, if he's to be remembered today, and the reason I thought that he deserved a biography. Was more to see how he embodied the period in which he lived and how quickly all of his ideals and what he stood for passed from the scene. And I thought that to understand what America was like then, which is really to understand the adolescence of this country, all of the problems, the responsibilities that we see now were beginning at the turn of the century, and you can see them in a kind of immature form. And to me, it was interesting to see, to look more closely at the man who, to the people of his time, embodied that day, and to see both how similar we are and how different we are today.
The title, Reporter Who Would Be King, is kind of an offshoot of a short story he wrote.
Yes, and in a way, it's as readers of the book will see, it's a bit of a dig, because Davis wrote a story that he titled, in fact, he got it a little wrong. He called it The Reporter Who Made Himself King. He was playing off a famous Kipling story, The Man Who Would Be King. Anyway, he wrote the story, and he was going to use it as the title story of a collection. And then he told his mother, who is a very shrewd literary politician, of his plans. And she said, don't be insane. If you do that, everyone will jump on you and tease you and make fun of you. So he called his collection of stories Cinderella, which is the name of another story. But I called this book The Reporter Who Would Be King, because in many ways that's what Davis was. He was a reporter who wanted to be, and indeed was more than a reporter, who wanted to be a major figure of his time, and was.
Now, just to wrap things up, is there an archive of, I should have probably checked the sources in the back, I didn't do that, but is there an archive of Richard Harding Davis material where you did your research?
The bulk of his letters were at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. Other letters, there is a grandson. The one child he had one son, and he lives out in California, and he, at the moment I have them, but on loan, he has a bulk of letters. There are other people, including the woman who was the secretary companion of Cecil Clark Davis in the last 20 years of her life. She lives in Santa Barbara today, and she had many of Cecil's letters, which no one had seen before.
What about Richard's diary?
Richard's diaries, the grandson had. So
was it a fairly complete diary, so you could trace things on a day-by-day basis?
You could trace things on a day-by-day basis, but it's not what we think of as a confessional journal. It's more, with very few exceptions, it's a very reticent journal, but it says what he was doing.
At least you knew where he was.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's half the battle, right?
Yeah.
There, isn't it?
Yeah, well, when letters are undated, as many of his are, you then need some kind of scaffolding to hang them on, and the diaries were useful.
Well, it's an illuminating book about a name that, of course, I knew of, but I didn't know anything about until I read The Reporter Who Would Be King. It's a fine job. Arthur Lugo, thank you very much.
Thank you.